Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The deeds of Coriolanus should not be uttered feebly. It is held that valor is the chiefest virtue and most dignifies the haver. If it be, the man I speak of cannot in the world be singly counterpoised.
That was Douglas Wilmer as Cominius in William Shakespeare's Coriolanus. Welcome to The Play's the Thing. I am Tim McIntosh, and I am joined by Sarah Jane Bentley for Act 2 of Coriolanus. Hey, Sarah Jane, welcome back.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you? How has your evening been?
It was quite peaceful up to a point, and then some fireworks went off. It's 8 o'clock in the evening here. And
so you must be celebrating some sort of national holiday if fireworks are going off. Is that the case?
Well, England has a national health service, which is distinctly different to the way that healthcare is arranged in the US. And the government suggestion at the moment is that we cheer the NHS at 8 p.m. every evening. So some people have started setting off fireworks and tooting the horns of their cars and things and getting very excited.
What?
And it woke up my baby.
So, what?
Yeah. So 8 o'clock is time to stand and clap for the NHS.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You can see me, Sarah Jane, we're using Zoom for this video conference, and you can tell that I am not in what you would call the most aesthetically pleasing environment. I'm in a...
Well, it depends what kind of aesthetics you like, really, because if you like exposed pipes, concrete walls,
this is your place.
Those
yeah.
beams. I mean, it's a very kind of, it's maybe an engineer's heaven.
Yeah. Maybe it is. It's not my heaven. I'm going to say that it's not my heaven. So I probably told you I live in a cottage that my friend Andrew and I built on his property. And last week, it seems so long ago now, I was on a conference call in my cottage, and I was looking at my friends at their house. Their oldest son, 14 years old, steps into the backyard from the house. He and following him is a little puff of smoke. And I thought to myself, and he doesn't look alarmed at all. And I just think, you know, someone has burned the beans on the stove, and there's a little bit of, there's smoke. And then I keep watching, and that little puff of smoke turns into a stream of smoke, and then it begins to just billow. So I quickly get off my conference call, and I go into the house, and there is smoke all up against the ceiling. There's a lot of smoke up against the ceiling, but I don't hear any evidence of fire. I don't see any evidence of fire. So I walk through the house, out the front door, and Marianne, Andrew's wife, is on the phone, and shortly after I step out, 9 paramedics and fire trucks all descend upon this house. I mean, it's like sirens blazing, and I'm like, what in the world's going on? Long story short, there was a fire in the closet where their hot water heater was. So Marianne opens, she hears something, she opens up the door, and there's a wall of flame behind the hot water heater. Terrifying. She puts it out, and that's when everybody shows up. The fire inspector eventually comes, and he says, it either happened for this reason or this reason or this reason. We're not really sure which one. But the long and short of it is, they had to move to an Airbnb. There's no hot water now, for obvious reasons, like was within the hot water heater closet. And so they got this big, nice Airbnb house really close to the water in Seattle. And they're like, Tim, come stay with us. And I said, please, because if you have not, like, remember the last time that you didn't have hot water, it makes you miss hot water. It makes you miss civilization so much. Like, hot water is so delightful. And when you don't have it, it's kind of rough.
I was captivated by the way you told that story. You're a really good storyteller because, you know, the little puff of smoke, I knew what was coming was going to be bad, but I wasn't sure if your house had burned down, there's going to be an explosion. So yeah, that's awful.
Yeah. So I'm in the laundry room of this big, beautiful house. Everybody's safe. I'm in the laundry room of this big, beautiful house. So that's the pipes and the...
Why doesn't it have a video conferencing suite?
I know. What a ripoff, Airbnb. Sarah Jane, Act 2 of Coriolanus. You and I talked on the first episode, how much we love this play. And one of the central questions about this play is about the character of Coriolanus. We both like Coriolanus, but we maybe have some reservations. After this act, I wanted to know your opinion. Is Coriolanus proud? We know let me preface it by saying, we know that he hates the common people. That's not a question. We talked about that for Act 1. But is he proud?
If he's humble at times, such as when he refuses to accept the praises of Cominius and the praises of the people and the praises of his mother, then that humility comes across as arrogance, almost as if he says, I don't want your praises either. Because why would that be? Because he doesn't think those people are worthy to praise him, or because he doesn't want his deeds to be owned by other people? As if he's saying, you know, I didn't do it for you. I just would have done this anyway. I don't need your praises. I don't know. I think he has a terrible proficiency at presenting himself as proud when in fact sometimes he isn't. But then if we look at what he does at the end of the play without giving it away,
yeah,
he is vengeance proud. And if he wasn't proud, perhaps he wouldn't have gone to seek revenge.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay, can I put a counterpoint to you? So it seems to me that when the people praise him, because he disdains them, he genuinely just does not want to hear their praise and their accolades. But if he identifies himself as a representative of the greatness of Rome, then when the other senators, or even when his mother praise him, he also brushes aside their praise, which I think that he's brushing aside their praise, not because, I'll just say what I think, because I think he's a little bit bashful. Like, I remember, you know, my father, who was the pastor of one church, and when he retired from that church 47 years later, you know, everyone wanted to put him on stage and heap accolades upon him. And my dad did not want to do it. It was so embarrassing to him. And I was reading that into Coriolanus's brushing aside of the praise from the senators and from his mother. Do you think that's a viable reading?
Definitely. And I think that's how Fiennes plays it.
Uh-huh.
I think Fiennes really conveys well this awkwardness that Coriolanus feels when his mother praises him. And he's portrayed as this sort of almost socially inept character who's at home in the war. And then when he's at home in peacetime, he has this kind of PTSD type inability to behave normally. So yeah, he does kind of cringe at his mother's praises, but then she knows that he craves her praise. At one point she says to him, "Now to have my praise for this, play a part." And he does it.
Uh-huh.
So there's a strange paradox there where he seeks her approval but can't bear to hear it spoken of in public.
Okay, we've got to talk about Volumnia now. His mother. He seems to love her more than he loves his own wife. Do you think that's true?
In a simple answer, I'd say yes, but I'd kind of like to flesh that out.
Please,
a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you think?
A simple answer is yes, and I want to flesh it out a little bit also.
Okay. Right. Well, great. You've graciously allowed me to go first. So I think there's... Okay, so there's a big disparity between the number of lines that Virgilia has, and Volumnia is a much bigger part. So in that sense, we don't see as much of his relationship with his wife as we do of his relationship with his mother. However, Virgilia is on the stage, often always with Volumnia, and seems kind of overpowered by Volumnia. So that is one thing that perhaps suggests that Coriolanus has more of a craving for his mother's attention, perhaps. The other thing that I think is slightly alien to us and that Shakespeare is obviously exploring here is that there is this cult of the Roman matron, mm-hmm. where the job of a Roman mother was to breed warriors. And the son is to honor the mother. And so in that sense, their relationship is very respectful and possibly quite normal in Roman society. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it really was normal that the mother would be revered above the wife when both of them are side by side. And obviously we don't very often see Virgilia and Coriolanus in private. Fiennes' film has colored my judgment on this a lot because he's cut lots of bits of the play to make it a much sharper contrast between Virgilia and Volumnia, where Coriolanus is completely, even almost sexually overpowered by his mother.
Yeah.
Then the Hiddleston version, all the scenes between Virgilia and Coriolanus are really tender, and it just seems almost as if it's just a relationship that's not explored very much in the play, but is perfectly loving. So
you mean the text doesn't explore it very much? I don't want to put words in your mouth. When you say that the play doesn't explore it very much, what do you mean?
That Virgilia has fewer lines than Volumnia.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we don't hear Coriolanus speaking to his wife as much.
Right. Our listeners should know, Sarah Jane and I have talked a little bit off the air about a few different productions that we have seen. One of them is the National Theater's production starring Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
And another is Alan Howard's production from the early 80s done for the BBC. And there's a third one we've talked about, and this one is openly accessible on YouTube. The Richard Burton version, it's just an audio version. There's no visuals to it, but it's the Richard Burton version that I think was done probably, what do you think, Sarah Jane? Maybe in the 60s, something like that?
Yeah, late 50s, 60s. There's also a fourth one, which is Fiennes in 2009, directed and starred in Coriolanus, and it's set in the Balkan Wars.
I want to press pause in the conversation we're having about the relationship between Coriolanus, his mother, his wife, for one moment. If you're going to recommend one of these productions, Sarah Jane, to someone who doesn't know, it's a first time acquaintance with Coriolanus, what are you going to recommend?
I think the Fiennes one, because it's a motion picture. It's a movie you can watch as a whole family. It's 2 hours, maybe less. So it's, you know, it's heavily cut, as you said, it feels really truncated, and it's a great war movie.
Yeah, it is. And I think Fiennes, Ralph Fiennes, I think he had a really clear vision of Coriolanus, and I thought he played him exceptionally well. Mm. On the Facebook page, I've been raving about Alan Howard. I think the Alan Howard, I'm not going to exaggerate. This is how I feel. I think the Alan Howard performance, it might be the best Shakespearean actor performance I have ever seen. I cannot take my eyes off him for 3 hours. It's a hard recording to find, but if you can find it, I found mine at the public library. A couple of other listeners mentioned that they have access to it at their public library. I do think that actually the Fiennes version is almost the better one to start with, and then the Alan Howard version. But we're going to talk more about different productions choices a little bit later in this show, and probably a lot in Act Three. But let's return to Volumnia and Coriolanus. I think, Sarah Jane, watching this play, it is very important to kind of, for me, remember one of the kind of symbols of Rome is that picture of the she-wolf nursing two human boys, that founding kind of myth of Rome, that Romulus and Remus were discarded from their biological mother, and they were somehow found by a she-wolf not far from the founding spot of Rome. And you can even see AC Roma, one of the Italian soccer clubs, has as their insignia the she-wolf suckling the two boys. And there's something about that picture of the relationship between the mother and these two warrior boys, soon to be warriors, that seems really deeply impressed upon this play. Volumnia is raising more than anything else. She's not raising a man. She's not raising a husband. She's not raising a son. She's raising a warrior, isn't she?
Had I 11 sons, what does she say? And she basically says, if I had 12 sons, I had rather 11 die in war than one surfeit out of action. So she sacrifices her sons. She has this delight, and you were talking to me off air about it. She has this delight in Coriolanus's wounds.
Yes.
Yes. She's really quite gory and bloody, and Virgilia's always there going, "Oh, Jupiter, no blood, please." So she sort of delights in having seeing her son butchered for Rome. She presents him to be butchered for Rome. I can't make up my mind exactly about the dynamics between Volumnia and Coriolanus. What do you think about that mother-son relationship?
Well, I think that there is this kind of expectation within Rome at the time that this is what a true noble woman of Rome does. She prepares her sons for war. But I also can't help but think that there's something about Coriolanus's affection for his mother that is born by the absence of his father. I mean, if I'm going to get like kind of psychological about it, father even, I think he's mentioned one time in the play.
Is he? I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe not even that. But there's times where his
I don't think he is.
Absence is so loud. His absence is, the father's absence is so loud. And so I don't know that the text would support this, but I just think sort of from a psychological point of view, there is a weight of approval.
Mm.
I think that he needs the sort of approval from his mother that might be caused by the absence of his father.
Interesting. That's really interesting. I always thought it was more because she has brought him up to crave that kind of attention. I can't decide whether she loves her son and he loves her dearly, and she tries to live vicariously through him, and uh-huh. he, out of respect for his mother, kind of placates her and honors her.
Yeah.
Whether it's more as Fiennes has presented it, where Volumnia is this sort of super tiger mother who has so dwarfed her son that he's kind of unable to do anything without thinking, will my mother approve of this? And he resents her for it, and yes. yet he can't do anything else. And I don't know which of those two is correct. I think you can, as a director, you could play it both ways and it would be really dramatic.
Okay, let's talk about the kind of influence that a director could have over this play. And I want to talk specifically about Act 2, Scene 3. So Act 2, Scene 1 is we're with Coriolanus's family, with Volumnia, with Virgilia, with Cominius, with Menenius, and we're hearing the rumors of his exploits against the Volscis at Coriolanus. This is where he receives the name Coriolanus. His mother even says, must I now refer to you as Coriolanus? Act 2, Coriolanus is praised in the Senate, and he's nominated to become a consul. So the section that we heard at the very beginning of the podcast was praise from Cominius. After that, it's sort of stated by the Senate, yeah, he's going to be consul, no problem. We just have to do this thing, Coriolanus. You have to go present your wounds to the people. Of course, Coriolanus hates this idea. He hates this idea. So, but he does it. He needs to become a consul. He wants to become a consul. His mother wants him to become a consul. So he wears the kind of gown. What is it called? The gown of humility.
Mm.
And in productions that I have seen, he strips to the waist. The people come see his wounds. They kind of fawn over him. They exchange words with him. And then he returns at the beginning of Act 3, which we'll talk about next week, to receive his consulship, having done the custom of revealing his wounds to the people. But not before we hear the tribunes, the representatives of the people, whispering words to the people about how actually Coriolanus disrespected them. He didn't really give them the sort of... he kind of begrudgingly accepted their praise and offered his service to them. So that's the setup for Act 3. When we begin Act 3, Coriolanus is going to be in the Senate and the tribunes are going to be revealing, oh, actually the people are against you. They don't want you to be consul. Now, I want to talk about the way that two of the actors that we have seen play the speech that Coriolanus gives the people while he's showing them their wounds. Remember, he does not like the people. And so there's this actor's choice. When the people come to him, he has to reveal his wounds to them. What is going to be his stance toward them? And you really liked what Tom Hiddleston did. Can you describe how Tom Hiddleston, the actor, how did he play that?
Yeah, so Tom Hiddleston read this scene really sarcastically. He plays Coriolanus in a very sarcastic way. So Coriolanus hates the people. He mocks them. The speech he makes, by Shakespeare's standards, is quite thin and poor. And Hiddleston plays that speech as if Coriolanus is speaking to people who have no understanding whatsoever, and he is so disrespectful to the people. And he treats them as if they're fickle and as if it doesn't really matter what he says. They'll just give him his votes anyway because they don't even have the intelligence to understand him. And he doesn't show them his wounds. That's one of the things that I think perhaps for me makes Hiddleston's role quite convincing, because he tells them he'll show them his wounds, but he never does. And that's what the tribunes then use to turn the people against him later. So Coriolanus has no humility in the scene.
In the Ralph Fiennes version, does he show them his wounds?
No.
Okay.
He's wearing a suit in that one.
Okay.
And he is very awkward. He's very awkward, but he's not mocking the people. He just comes across as a terrible public speaker.
Yes.
Whereas Hiddleston's Coriolanus comes across as an extremely accomplished public speaker who uses sarcasm so well that the people don't even realize he's being sarcastic towards them until the tribunes tell them that they've been duped.
Yes. I'm going to read that section. So it's 2:3, and the lines are 1:21 to roughly 1:27. So this is Coriolanus after three more citizens approach him. Here come more voices. Your voices. For your voices I have fought, watched for your voices. For your voices, bear of wounds 24 odd, battles 36 I have seen and heard of. For your voices have done many things, some less, some more. Your voices, indeed, I would be counsel.
It's not very persuasive, is it?
Not at all. It's so thin. You can hear something, and that's the question. That's the question that we're talking about. Do you hear disdain? This is what Hiddleston chooses. You hear like there's disdain. Like, I'm not even going to, I have the rhetorical power to say something deliciously profound and honorific. But I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. You're not worth my time. And then the Fiennes version is, I just feel so awkward.
Yeah.
I feel so, this custom makes me feel so embarrassed that I can't really think of anything profound and moving to say, because I just am kind of like bound into myself here.
I don't want to be here.
I don't want to be here. So for me, Sarah Jane, I did not like, I think Hiddleston's choice as an actor, I think the text lends itself to that choice. However, I think that what I did not like about that was he, for me, he kind of broke character a little bit and kind of stood beneath the station of Coriolanus, if that makes sense.
Right.
I felt like he stepped down from his kind of high place, which he's always fighting to preserve, so that he could kind of, in my worst, I will not say that this is what Hiddleston was doing, but I had this kind of reaction of, oh, he's playing for the audience here. Mm. He's getting it.
Yeah, and it makes a mockery of the, is it after we seen two later, where his mother has to beg him to go and do it again. And he says, I can't be anything other than who I am. I'm an honest man. And yet he's already done it.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I do see what you mean. Yeah, that's a good point. Because it doesn't leave him anywhere to go then the next time he goes back to the people. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I liked Fiennes' version better. So Sarah Jane, I've got this kind of a somewhat larger theological question that I want to pose to you. We mentioned that this play really thematically focuses on this juxtaposition and this violent conflict between an elite warrior with a profound amount of skill who in many ways is undermining, I don't know if he's undermining, he is not in keeping with Roman religion in this key way. Rather than praise the gods, he seems almost to consider himself one. Whereas the tribunes, on the other hand, are rallying the people. They're the popular voice, and they're rallying the people, and they speak the language that they know will resonate with the people. And it made me think, okay, as a Christian living in a republic, living in a democracy, this kind of choice has been front and center so many times in the history of democracies and republic. An elite leader who does not share any sort of Christian convictions, and a populist leader who at least gives voice to some sort of common understanding of Christian conviction. And my question for you, if it's not too massive and abstract, is if you're a Christian, you kind of like recognize these two tectonic plates pushing up against each other. Who do you support? The populist who speaks the language, the elite that has great skill but seems to have no shared conviction? Like, what do you choose?
Taking it out of the play, I suppose, in real life, I would choose whoever lives nearest. So if...
Oh, what a fascinating answer. I don't know what you mean.
So I think politics is best if it's kept local.
Ah.
So I think G.K. Chesterton said something like, you know, it's good to keep politics local so that, you know, you can kick your local MP if you need to. He said it a lot better than right. I just said it. But that's what I mean is that you want them to be accountable directly to the people that they represent. The problem in the play is that Coriolanus seems to be a supporter of statism and big government. And he sees the state as the people's salvation, and that, you know, the state will give them corn at the state's own price. The state will provide protection, like military protection. But in return, the people have to be totally subjugated. And I think there are problems with that, because as one of the people say in the play, what is Rome but the people?
Mm-hmm.
So I can see Coriolanus's problem with democracy is he's saying, how can we, the elites, be governed by a people who don't know what they want?
Yeah.
And as soon as the people have power, it takes power away from the patricians. And yes. Coriolanus sees this as his huge problem. So he also doesn't want to be a politician, fair play to him.
At all, right, right.
He also is like, just let me go and fight the wars. Don't make me be a politician. I won't be any good at it. So I don't know what's right exactly. I think in the best possible way, you'd want whoever it is who represents you politically to live nearby so you can knock on their door and say, hey.
About that bill that you introduced.
And that politics is as local as possible and mm-hmm. not this kind of abstract, absent, massive state that you can't talk to as a human being.
Right. Now, a little bit of the background of the first performance of this play is that King James is on the throne. And you mentioned off the air that I'll just ask the question. Could Coriolanus be read as an indictment from Shakespeare to King James?
I think so. That's a really insightful observation, that Shakespeare is carefully at a great remove. You know, he's gone to ancient Rome to show this. He's suggesting perhaps that a leader who is totally autocratic and has no respect for the people is dangerous for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that James would have seen that. But of course, Coriolanus is the hero of the play. So
right.
Shakespeare hasn't disparaged the king by criticizing Coriolanus. And obviously, Shakespeare can easily say, well, no, Coriolanus is not James the First. Please don't cut my head off. He's right, just a Roman general.
However, this is the last of the tragedies that Shakespeare writes. So maybe... Who knows? Obviously, this is a wild speculation. Maybe James kind of pulled Bill aside and said, hey, I don't think you're going to write any more of those.
Yeah, it's a bit close to the bone.
Too close to home. That's right. Exactly right.
I mean, James was quite James was quite unusual in his conception of the divine right of kings, more so than his predecessor. Elizabeth I, I think, did see herself as a servant of the people. Mm. But James considered himself to be above the people and as this kind of intercessor between the people and God, because his belief in the divine right of kings is that he can do no wrong, essentially, that he is appointed right. by God, and therefore everything he does is almost like a divine act. So that caused all kinds of hostility between him and Parliament. And in fact, he suspended Parliament for years, didn't let them have any debates or anything. So he was ruling autocratically in a sense.
Other rulers also believed in the divine right of kings, but James sort of adrenalized it, put it on steroids in some ways.
Yeah, I think he really truly believed in it and acted upon right. it. Yeah,
right. Sarah Jane, there's a word that shows up repeatedly, especially in this act: voices. So in that short speech that I read from Coriolanus. Your voices, for your voices I have fought. Watch for your voices bear of wounds through this. So that word shows up probably six times in those 10 lines. I keep hearing something more than just votes. I mean, clearly Coriolanus is referring to votes when he says, I have done these great deeds of valor for your votes, because you are part of the governing body of this great country. Am I wrong to read something more into that word voices? Or is it just kind of a step in for votes?
I mean, I think it does mean votes, but yeah, there could be more in it. Perhaps could it also mean your opinion in a sense?
Yeah.
And if Coriolanus is saying, I respect your voices individually, then uh-huh. that would also add weight to his hatred of the tribunes, because the tribunes then speak as one voice for all the people right. and disregard all the individual voices of the people, but speak for the majority.
So
perhaps Coriolanus is saying, I don't need anyone to intercede between you and the patricians. You can speak for yourselves.
Do you think that he would actually respect them if they spoke for themselves and didn't have to have an intercessor, i.e. the tribunes?
I don't think he'd ever stand close enough to them to be able to hear what they have to say. He says, I hate your breath, I hate,
yeah,
he says.
Yeah.
No, he really does seem to loathe the people.
In 2:1, when Menenius is speaking to them, he has these lines where one of the citizens says something to the effect of, I'll speak for myself. And Menenius is like, no, you won't. You're incapable of, would that you could speak for yourself, but this is the problem of the many-headed Hydra, is you can't speak for yourself. You can't act alone. And that's a common complaint, both from Coriolanus, but also from Menenius, that that's a cause of disdain for them, that they cannot speak for themselves. And it's a funny complaint, because to speak for yourself demands some level of education, social standing, the sorts of things that the upper class can take for granted. And so it's another example of one of the fissures between these two classes of people, that the upper class blames the lower class for something that they are just not capable of doing. Not because they blame the lower class for something that has not been provided for them that they can't provide for themselves.
That's right. And wasn't there, I mean, in ancient Greece, the idea was that the plebs, and also in Rome, I think the plebs are just, they're breeders. They just produce children, and then the state will take those children and make something of them. And some will be discarded. In fact, I was reading a theologian the other day who was looking at Plato as essentially the first Marxist, in a sense, in that he idolized the state, thought that the state should bring up the children. But obviously he wasn't a materialist, so it's kind of not quite the same, but it was interesting. And the Senate, the patricians in Rome are not providing education for these people. It's in their interest for that gap to be as wide as possible.
Right.
And I think what you're saying is so true, that they can't really speak for themselves. I think to be able to speak for yourself, you have to be able also to back up those words with deeds.
Right.
And these people can't act for themselves either, it seems. And that's something that bothers Coriolanus, because he is a man of deeds. And then his words simply kind of describe or explain what he has done. Or quite often his deeds speak for themselves. He says at one point in the play, "Where blows have made me stay, I fled from words." He says that to Sicinius and Brutus.
Yes.
Because he can't bear to hear all these whirling words praising the things that he's done.
Yes.
He says, "I can't stay to hear my nothings monstered."
And do you think that's a statement that only a man of his privilege could make?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I suppose he's of such a status that the blind and the dumb come out to see him return from Coriolis, that mm-hmm. he's got this kind of cult following. I see it almost like he's trying to say, you can't own the things that I've done by putting your own gloss on them.
Oh, yeah.
I did them myself. And you can say what you like about it, but that doesn't make it the property of Rome or...
Right. Right.
I don't know, though, because on the other hand, everything he does for Rome, so...
Right. And there's something that I so deeply respect about the fact that he wants his deeds to speak, and he values them so much more than he values even his own words. I really respect that. I mean, he's a man who's like, yes is yes, is no is no. I mean, almost to a violent degree. But I think it's one of the things that we're meant to appreciate about him. Mm. As you said in the first act recording, he tells the truth. Mm. Like, there's just no bending him. And it's one of the most admirable things about him. He always tells the truth.
Yeah, there's no dissembling. And when he tries to lie, he very quickly erupts and starts telling the truth.
Yes, right.
Quite quickly and awkwardly immediately. It's true. And his deeds are phenomenal, aren't they? I mean, there's never been a warrior like him. As Cominius said at the beginning in the clip he played, he's been fighting since the age of 16, comparable maybe to someone like Othello. He won the Oaken Garland when he was, I think it says 17 years old.
And what does that mean, the Oaken Garland, Sarah Jane?
Well, this is what something kind of praise I got is that? Quite interested in. So it's the garland, the wreath that he's given to wear when he goes to the capital to receive his name, Coriolanus. And in Rome, the Oaken Garland was a symbol of valor.
Yes.
And I tried to look at why the oak tree and not another tree. And I didn't find any really good answers to that, but obviously oak trees are majestic, old,
sturdy.
Yeah. So the Oaken Garland then is a symbol of his valor. And the other imagery that I've been interested in the play to do with oaks is that Coriolanus is often compared to a tree. He describes himself as a trunk towards the end of the play. And at the beginning, if you remember in Act One, the speech you played at the beginning of last episode, he speaks about oaks being hewn with rushes.
Yes.
So I see Coriolanus as the oak who is cut down by these reeds, and the reeds are the people, the weak
right.
people of Rome, as he sees them,
right.
Who end up chopping down this incredible oaken garland wearing warrior because they can't make up their minds.
For me, one of the reasons that I adore this play so much is that I think that this might be the most thematically unified of all of his plays.
Mm.
To compare it with something like Midsummer Night's Dream, Midsummer Night's Dream is full of fancy and whimsy, and it is a vines and tendrils grow out in every direction. And sometimes it's easy to forget that there's a plot in Midsummer Night's Dream. And I don't know that it's terribly important that we remember there's a plot, because it's just, it's so playful and fun. This play, by contrast, it is only talking about one thing over and over and over and over. I mean, it's the people versus this one man, and the kind of refractory lenses that we look at that conflict. The lenses might change slightly. Sometimes we're looking through the eyes of Volumnia, sometimes through the eyes of Brutus, sometimes through the eyes of Cominius, but it's always about that. Always about that.
There doesn't seem to be a subplot at all. There isn't one, is there?
No, right. No, I don't think there is.
And it's the most, as far as I know, it's the most kind of purest sort of adherence to the form of a Greek tragedy.
Yeah, where, it's very Aristotelian. Like Aristotle would just adore this play.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It's constructed it so beautifully.
It really is.
It's chiastic in a way that the second half of the play reflects the first half. So there are three times that Coriolanus has to go to the people to eventually become a member of the Senate. And then in the other half of the play, there are three suits sent to him to try to stop him.
Yes.
From destroying Rome. And he kneels to his mother in this scene. Later on, we see she kneels to him, and it's just perfectly mirrored.
So walk our audience through chiastic. What is that word? What does that word mean?
It's from the Greek letter chi, which is an X. And it means that you can look at each side of the piece of work as a mirror. So it's constructed in a kind of mirror fashion. Have I explained that very well on air? Probably not. If you think of a flight of swans. If you think of a flight of swans in that arrowhead, we go up in one direction, then we come back down again in the same direction.
So it's almost, if you thought of it in terms of a rhyming scheme, like a lot of simple nursery rhymes are A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D. But a chiastic scheme would be something like A, B, C, B, A.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the mirror that we see, and this is part of the reason why I'm so excited about Act Three, the kind of breaking point of the play happens in Act Three, and the second half of the action kind of mirrors, as you were saying, the first half of the action.
Yeah,
of the play.
It all pivots around that moment.
Right. And so for me, do you think that the pivot moment, and we'll talk about this more next week, is when he is cast out of Rome, or is it when he breaks with the Senate?
I think it's when he's banished. That's what I think. But
I think so too.
I could be wrong.
I think so too.
It seems to pivot around that moment, because at that point he leaves Rome, he denounces it, he becomes titleless, and he goes and looks for another identity.
Right. So let's look forward, Sarah Jane, to Act Three. Knowing what we know, what's been set up for us in Act Two, what should we be looking for in Act Three? There's this growing pressure, this growing animosity between Coriolanus, the great warrior, the accomplished warrior, and the two tribunes, who are kind of representing, not just representing the people, but also turning the people against Coriolanus. Now, what should we look for in Act Three?
Oh, my favorite scene, Act Three, Scene Two.
And Act Three, Scene Two
love it. When Volumnia beseeches, manipulates, bullies chastises her son. It's just the most remarkable piece of theatre. And that's another turning point in the play as well, where you see the greatest warrior in Rome go and do the bidding of his mother. And it, and she uses nothing but words.
For me, Act 3, Scene 1 is like, it's so funny that right, our like favorite scene, like you just gave 3-2 really high praise. And I'm going to say, I mean, I love 3-2. 3-1 for me is, it's as good as it gets in the whole canon. I mean, it's just incredible. And it is all wordplay. That's part of the reason why it's so stunning to me is that it's all wordplay, unlike something like Macbeth sneaking into Duncan's chamber to kill him or returning. There's so much visceral action in those scenes. There's no visceral action in those in 3-1 or even in 3-2 or even in 3-3. It's all rhetorical power. Mm. And I just think that Shakespeare just turned the knob all the way up.
Mm. That's right. Most of the action in this play is off stage, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. We get some at the end of Act 1, the battle scene, but most of the power of this play is through the speeches.
Going back to the speech you played at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a bit of political gloss going on there in Cominius' speech that he's perhaps...
I hadn't thought of that. Do you think so?
Well, he seems to be praising Martius as if he alone took the city of Corioles. And Martius indeed believes this by the end of the play. It's what he says. But so the metaphor... No, it's a simile, actually, that Cominius uses is he says... Coriolanus struck Corioles like a planet, which makes him seem like this meteor that comes in out of nowhere and smacks into the city. But in fact, there are lots of small scenes in Act 1 in the battle, and we see that, in a way, Coriolanus gets distracted and goes off to fight his arch nemesis in this private duel and goes and fights Aufidius. And Titus Lartius is there, tying up all the loose ends. He's secured the gates. He's set a watch upon the city. He goes to find Cominius. And so, in a sense, I'm not sure Coriolanus does do it entirely on his own, but he almost believes the hype.
Has
convinced himself that he did. But Titus Lartius is also a great warrior.
He is.
It's a controversial opinion, maybe, but I think... If we look at Act 1, Scene 8, we can see Titus Lartius does do a great deal to secure the city of Corioles.
He certainly deserves more credit than he's given in the play. And maybe he's the sort that he just wants to heap the praise upon his leader, Coriolanus. But yeah, wouldn't it be nice if he got a little bit of, just a little bit of show from Cominius, a little bit of thanks from Cominius.
And obviously Cominius is trying to get Coriolanus elected, so that there is a political incentive.
So Sarah Jane, I'm going to give our listeners a little bit of homework. I'm going to ask them to listen to two parts of 3-1 or selections of 3-1 as performed by two actors. And just because I really would like for them to hear kind of how choices from actors and directors can so deeply shape, what we appreciate when we see the end of a production. So, the Richard Burton version, I'm going to ask listeners to listen to, and the Alan Howard version. I'll supply both of those via Facebook. And I think Richard Burton's choice is: I want to be clear. I want the audience to understand what I'm saying, and that's the way he plays it. I think Alan Howard doesn't care. I think he just wants to kind of turn on this sort of fire hydrant of emotion. And that's what's really being conveyed to the audience. And for next week, I'm going to ask you a question, but not until then. What do you do when you're seeing an actor who is just, when you cannot keep up with the words and the concepts and the metaphors because they're so dense? What do you do as an audience member? Because we've all been in that situation before. We don't quite know what's going on in Shakespeare. Like, what do I do now? Am I going to lose the plot? So be prepared. That's what I'm going to ask you next week.
You've given me some homework to do as well. I'm supposed to be on maternity leave.
I know. I'm not giving you any rest at all, am I? Everybody, remember that you can join us online on Facebook through the Close Reads discussion group, or on Instagram or Twitter at Close Reads Pods, and by email by writing to closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. Sarah Jane, any last words?
Just, can I just say my favorite line?
Please.
I had rather be their servant in my way than sway with them in theirs.
It's a great line.
I love that line.
It's a great line. My favorite is from 3:1. I'm going to foreshadow it.
I bet I can guess it.
Yeah, guess it.
Okay. Is it where he's talking about two authorities, neither supreme?
I love that, but that's not the one.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I love it, though. Mine is, shall mark you this triton of the minnows. I just love it.
Triton of the minnows.
Finally, one of those tributes
his
is like here directly from him.
Shall.
His absolute shall. Thanks, everybody, for listening. For Sarah Jane Bentley and for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I am Tim McIntosh. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.